Hey, everyone. A quick note about this week's episodes. Our guest is Ken Krause, a former U.S. Marine who was kidnapped, tortured, and sentenced to death in Iran in 1979. Now, obviously, he survived or we wouldn't have him as a guest, right? But Ken's going to discuss his ordeal during that time, which includes gun battles, beatings, torture, murder, and the resultant PTSD he experienced. Some might find portions of this three-part interview disturbing. Most of you won't. But I just wanted to give you a heads up just in case. Ken Krause is a true American patriot and hero, and I'm honored to host him on the Game of Crimes. Hope you all enjoy this week's episodes.
And basically, that's why I named the book or titled the book, A Marine That Endures Hell, because it was hell. It really was. You read it, you'll have to agree with that.
And yeah.
It's you just to go through hell, it's endure it. And you go through the fire, you get cleansed, or you learn just realizes how low you can really go in the depression, and you can get beat up to a point where you're totally exasperated and there's absolutely nothing left. And that's when I'm not being religious anymore, than I'm being political, is that that you find that you have your faith, your personal faith in God Almighty. And it changes your life and changes your world.
It does.
And it was overwhelming.
All right, everybody. We're back for part three of this week's episode of Game of Crimes with Murph in the Morning. You see this young gentleman we got here, you know who we're talking to because you've already watched the first two episodes this week with Ken Krause. A former Marine, combat Marine, was kidnapped, tortured, and rescued out of Iran back in 1979. The first Marine to be held hostage over there. Gone through the parts, the torture parts. Yesterday was a tearjerker. When we finished, I had to get some tissues out. And I'm not ashamed to say it because I'm proud of what this man has done. He has almost given his life. I mean, shot in the chest with a shotgun and then to be brutally tortured over and over and over again. Ken, just so proud to have you on the show here, brother. And thank you so much for coming back for a third episode, because that's not common on Game of Crimes.
Hey, glad to be here, Steve. Thank you so much for the opportunity. Appreciate
yes,
it a lot.
Well, we're gonna get you on through this because I know some people are wanting to know. Yesterday, we finished up that you were out of Iran airspace and you're landing in Germany. And then you're going into the hospital there. Is that correct?
Medical center. Yes, sir.
And then how long were you in Germany and they're fixing you up before they put you on a plane and sent you back to the United States?
24 hours.
Wow. I don't think they could have done a whole lot. 24 hours, could they?
Well, it's either going to keep you 24 hours and do a triage, from what I understood, mm-hmm. and then monitor you on the plane coming back to the United States, where it's just going to be another few hours, where they had everything set up at Walter Reed Army Hospital, that depending on the triage, whatever the doctors had seen or found in Germany, to go ahead and let the people in Washington, D.C. know just how bad it was. And because they said that I didn't know about it, but once we left Wiesbaden, Germany, I got a briefing on the aircraft coming home. And it was weird because it was a lieutenant colonel who actually was just getting ready to be promoted to colonel. And he was there to brief me on the plane about what had happened. And because it was still a whirlwind for the last couple of weeks, or the last 8 days at least, mm-hmm. of what had happened and what, happened around the world, and just how popular, per se, if you want to use that word, my situation was. I had no clue. Remember, when we were talking about it, they had 24 hours to get me out of Tehran, or they were going to go ahead and execute me according to the fatwa, the court order for my, mm-hmm. my death. Mm-hmm. So it was wham, bam, thank you, ma'am kind of thing, where what they needed to do. And on the plane over there, across the big pond, on my way home, I got a briefing that was just absolutely amazing. So
can it wasn't give us a little bit of insight into that, if you would.
Yeah, I want to do that. That's important. They had had to clean me up, haircut, shower and shave and everything, and look at the wounds, re-bandage them, of course, is that, look at the cuts in the faces, the little stab wounds that I had had, the how bad the tooth was, you know, cracked and broken off. They were really concerned, really, with the shotgun blast to the chest and the lower abdomen area, where I had been wearing my basically my ballistic flak jacket, but it was open from where they had opened it to basically search me for weapons, I guess. I don't know. But once the blast hit there, only the area that was open was where I got actually shrapnel or shotgun wound. They couldn't. They said that basically they're going to patch me up and clean up the wound, and that when I got back over to the United States, of course, they were going to have a lot better shot at looking at what they need to do. Because if they started to do something there in Germany and it got compounded, and I didn't understand at the time, but when I get into the story, I'll tell you. There was an entourage waiting back in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know that when I got on the plane, and it was a C-141 Starlifter. I remember it to this day because I remember the tail number on it. And it's 10040, almost like a zip code. And what's unique about it is that for the longest time when the ATM machines were very popular, I used that a lot for passwords were for that number. It's just a nostalgia type thing. But anyway, being on the bird, we took off the next morning, and the colonel was saying, once we're airborne and we're comfortable, they had to resuit me for everything. They had, of course, I had nothing. I was in civilian clothes mm-hmm. when I left the ambassador's residence to the airport. And then when I got there to the Wiesbaden, it was a whirlwind. I was going from one doctor to another, to an examination room, to x-ray room, back and forth, and almost falling asleep in between. And I said, what's the big hurry? And then he says, you'll find out when you get on the plane. I said, what plane and when? So they explained it to me, and I said, okay, that's fine. I mean, you're running this show. And I said, but what's the big hurry? And he says, you'll get a briefing on the aircraft. And once we took off, the colonel introduced himself, and he said, I realize, Sergeant, that you haven't had much of an opportunity to get any of your questions answered. Well, I'm here to give you a briefing. And I'm saying to myself, I said, why do they use a field grade colonel to brief a lonely little sergeant here? Either something is really big and important or super secret and classified, or this guy pissed somebody off and they're giving him a tale or two. So, of course, I didn't say that to him, but that's the only really two ways it's going to be. Anybody could have given me the briefing, I guess. And he was an Air Force colonel, by the way. He was very nice, very cordial. And he said, speak freely, as if I still had to call him sir back and forth. I knew his first name as he introduced himself, but I just didn't feel comfortable at that point talking to him like that, even though there was almost nobody on the plane besides us. And I'm saying, my God, what's it cost per hour to fly a C-141 across the pond just for me? And so it's crazy. But he had told me, he said, you realize how important you have been in the last 7 to 8 days? And I said, no, sir, not at all. It's been a whirlwind, and my mind hasn't really been on it. Less than 24 hours ago, I was getting ready to be executed in a very dark hellhole part of the earth. Now, I mean, I'm on a plane going home, and all the way home, right to the U.S., my backyard. No, I haven't had an opportunity. Nobody really wanted to volunteer that information to me. Everybody that I talked to has always been above my pay grade and just told me it's one of those hush, hush, we'll get to you, quiet, sit down, shut up, listen. So who am I to argue with? They're getting me home. I don't care. It's a meal ticket home. And that's what I wanted more than anything in the world, is to get this nightmare to stop. But anyway, on the brief on the way over there, which in the special edition of my book, the first is detailed out very well. And I had to go back in for the special edition in addition to the paperback and the hard copy. So everything's identical in all three for the very basic, if you know what I mean, in the book. So, but if you do get the special edition, you're going to be getting some very, very updated information about my debrief that I'm going to tell you about, and some unique pictures that no one has ever seen before. And I have the originals of these that actually, while we were given the briefing, I was there. They were being smuggled out with me from Iran. And the State Department and other people wanted to take a look at those and see them for what they were worth. But I was just told to, take them with me, keep quiet. I didn't even know what they were. When you take a look at some of the pictures that I show you, you'll see me being escorted out to the Mehrabad airport. And really, for the most part, that's being deported. It wasn't being escorted. It was being deported. But they never checked up underneath my shirt or anywhere where I could have hid these photographs and newspaper articles that, you know, coming right out of Tehran. It's kind of unique that way. But the colonel sat me down. We had some coffee right there and just chit-chatted. And he said, what did you know and when did you first know it? And I told him, Colonel, I knew nothing of it whatsoever. I mean, we have the assault on the embassy. I get hurt. I get shot. And I'm taken off the compound. I never knew where I was for those 8 days until Jack Schellenberger and the International Red Cross showed up, introduced themselves literally minutes before I was to be executed. There's no short of definition of a miracle than that one right there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, sit back, son. Let me tell you exactly what had happened. And he said, you understand what the strategic arms limitation talk is, right? The SALT one. I said, well, basically, yeah, right. It's us and Jimmy Carter, President Carter, trying to talk the Russians into disarming and getting rid of some of the high-tech nukes that, you know, we just keep making more nukes and more nukes for the most part. And mm-hmm. It was a treaty that was running out and that Carter would love to have the SALT two limitations in there. And I said, that's great. Congress wasn't going to allow him to have that in the political world unless they could, you know, you remember the saying, trust but verify. That's right. That's where all this came in from. And I said, okay, yeah, we're a little familiar with that. He said, the human intelligence that works up and around out of the embassies and the consulate buildings in Tehran and other parts of Iran itself, they were there at the time. I got to tell the listeners here to think back about 1979. We're still looking at the time of not the friendly Russians we have now. Okay. We're looking back with El Gorbachev and the Soviet Union. Europe is still divided with the Iron Curtain. Germany is not unified yet. Berlin still a surrounded city. This is just, 4 years, 5 years after Vietnam. So we haven't had a lot of opportunities to use the American military in a positive way since the fall of Saigon. When you forward all this stuff here and you put it in perspective, I said, yes, sir, I understand that. That's part of our job at the embassy is keep these people safe and secure so that they can do their job for the rest of the country and the intelligence. He said, well the Russians knew this also, and they had actually hired or supported the Fedayeen Khalk, which is a communist Muslim or Muslim communist, however you want to say it. I still can't get my head wrapped around the concept to assault the embassy, basically take it out literally off the map or out of use. So that's the people that actually had attacked you. They were enemies of Khomeini for the most part. In the civil war over there with the size of Iran, you have a lot of tribal type of people. And although not all of them really liked the Shah, not all of them also liked Khomeini either. They weren't very friendly. Is that once they were given weapons and they were given freedoms, then Khomeini came in and, for the most part, wanted to just collect up the weapons, say, thank you very much for helping me overthrow the Shah. I'm now in charge and I'm going to make the rules. Well, there's a lot of factions over there that said, hey, not so fast there, weird beard. We want to have some input into this too. So he had to calm down a lot of people that were not just going his way and taking his orders from him directly. And you'll see some of those photographs I was talking about of him hugging and being very friendly and chummy with Yasser Arafat. I guess you want to call him the president or whatever, leader of the PLO at the time, Palestinian right. Liberation Organization. And they brought them in, another bunch of, you know, paid thugs. I said, basically, what's the Palestinians got to do with the Persians over here in the Middle East? But it's politics, especially religious politics and civil war, make very strange bedfellows.
Absolutely.
So I said, where do I come in on this? He says, well, they didn't count on, for the most part, you in particular and the other Marines that you were with, you know, to put up such a damn heroic and good fight. I said that explains a little bit of why they took our M16s away and gave us shotguns. And he said, well, I'm not specifically open to discuss why they did that. It was a State Department decision authorized by the White House. I said, nice. Supposedly, they didn't want to turn the place into an Alamo, but you basically did put us in direct harm's way where we couldn't do our jobs and we couldn't defend ourselves in that firefight. There's another miracle that I talk about in those books, and you'll see that I was the only American, the only Marine that was wounded or actually injured in that combat, call it what you want, mm-hmm. and the assault and the siege. there was dozens more that were Iranians, and a lot of them that were the attackers, the terrorists themselves, that were shot and killed. They counted on that, but they weren't going to count on us being sacrificed, so that, no, they couldn't stop it. They had nobody. They knew that maybe it was going to be assaulted. They sensed it, and the things that they did or failed to do prove that or support that supposition. With that being said, they had no government at the time to talk to in Iran. There hadn't been any elections. Khomeini had only been in office or power for a couple of weeks. Shapour Bakhtiar and the Bazigan interim governments, you couldn't get hold of them. Nobody was talking to anybody. Remember, there was no internet, you know, it's 1979.
Right.
So I said, yeah, I pretty much understand that, sir. You don't hire us and do the same mentality you got in Vietnam, send us into a place where we can't win and, you know, handcuff us and give us a rule book when the enemy can do any damn thing they want to us. Mm-hmm. And he says, oh, well, he says, that just seems like to be the nature of the military nowadays. I said, well, if that's the case, it is, sir. I said, my list spins up. You've seen the end of me. And it just made him feel a little uneasy that I feel like it was the best leadership position to be in at that point. It's so ironic, is that because hours earlier, I'm sitting there with my life on the line defending the very same people that put us in harm's way. So
yep.
It's a mixed blessing, and it's ironic. But he says, I guess you look at it from a principle point of view. Yes, sir, it's a very much principle point of view is what we're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, we didn't know where you were, and if it wasn't for that photograph by the BBC photographer showing you in that medical facility, he said, we would have never known where you were. You would have probably perished in Avin prison. And I said, that's amazing. And he says, now, with that being said, you've been given some newspaper articles and some photographs and things. I said, well, I was given a package to make sure that nobody saw, and basically smuggle it out with myself. She said, well, why don't you open that up and let's take a look at that. When we did, it's got the pictures, and it's the best way to describe it is either come to one of my lectures or book signings or get a special edition, because they have the photographs there. Photographs that you would never believe they would put out of some of them in the middle of a civil war.
Mm-hmm.
The barbarism and the terror that was shown to their own people. There's as horrible as some of the things we've gone through in America, they've never shown pictures like this.
Right.
And I got the originals. I keep them. Washington seen them and made copies of them. I guess, for the most part, if I don't give them to my family as family heirlooms, they'd probably be sent to the, a museum or the Smithsonian or something like that. So, when we went over them, I was just looking at the pictures, and he said, there's one in particular that's got pictures of four generals that work for the Shah. Basically, they're about the same as our Joint Chiefs of Staff for the Pentagon. And it shows them before and after they were riddled with bullets. So they're all sitting there with a picture just like me here. And then this picture, you see them beat, shot, mangled, and you couldn't even barely tell who they were. And they put that out there in the newspapers, in the Kahan and the Tehran Journal and the English version and the French version for everybody else to see. It was pretty hideous. I mean, this is your pictures of your dad, your uncle, your husband, your brother, your father, and to see them like that is one of the most disrespectful and barbaric things that I had to go through. And it didn't surprise me at all, because I was in that prison where these guys were, and where they were executed, probably would have been executed by the same firing squad, you know, definitely condemned by the same religious tribal mullahs that were there. So he said, let me tell you what's be waiting for you when you get down to Andrews Air Force Base. You're a national hero. I go, how's that, sir? He said that the Commandant of the Marine Corps, the Secretary of the Defense, Secretary of the Navy, your president, and more members of his staff, the Marine 8th and I Band is going to be there, the president's own, and you're going to be awarded commendations and medals. And I looked at him, I said, what? For what reason? And he says, well, some of those people that you had saved with your decision in the Caravanserai restaurant or during the assault at the embassy were special intelligence agents. And I said, I knew that they work. We call them secret squirrels because we know they work for one of the alphabet agencies. Well, you got CIA, FBI, Secret Service, NRO, NSA. They just keep coming. There's tons of them. Right. Everybody's got a different job there. You never really know exactly who they are or who they work for, but you just got to know that they're a valuable asset that can't be harmed or kidnapped or even killed. I said, yes, sir, I had an inkling that that's, but they just happen to be there. Even if they weren't intelligence people, just the idea that they were non-combatants and that if we continue to fight when we're low on ammo, one or two more assaults, we're inevitably going to bring it down to hand-to-hand. You're going to fight with a blade. And, it's, and he says, yeah, we understood that. They would have slaughtered those people. They would have had their way with them. And the women, who knows, it would have been a bloodbath. Mm-hmm. He said, for them to get out and for you to have exchange yourself that way. I said, sir, it was another miracle. I just got lucky to, I was able to get the jump on the guy and he negotiated a gunpoint. He really didn't have a choice. If he didn't take that deal, I was going to blow his brains out. And that's all there was to it. And then that really would have been the end of the game right there. Mm-hmm. He said, we know all this. I said, how do you know all this? He said, well, we've interviewed people already who was in the embassy with you at the restaurant. We have the facts and the figures. I said, okay, there's a, you know, you got a 27-acre compound there. There's a little firefights all over. The chargé d'affaires or the DCM, deputy chief of mission, his house, the ambassador's house, the embassy building, the chancery itself. There was dozens of little firefights everywhere. And the Marines were split up, and there probably was four or five spots where just two or three of us were separated. And we had no communication, no command or control. It was a almost perfectly overrun, perfectly planned ambush and overrun. And he said, we understand that. I said, what are you trying to tell me here, Colonel? And he said, I just want you to be ready. He says that it's going to be a big thing that when you land at Andrews. There's going to be an entourage there. We will find out if the president himself is going to be there. He had planned to be there. I said, that's great. I remember when I was back at the ambassador's house that night, I did talk with President Carter. He called and while one of the medics were looking at me and said that I got a call for you. The call went through. And I thought it was going to be my mother at first. And no, she said, okay, he's on. And I just remember the guy handed me the phone. He says, Sergeant Krause, this is the president of the United States. I went, whoa. Yeah. I said, yeah. And so we talked for about 5 minutes and he said, congratulations. I'm glad I got out of there alive. And he did everything he could. Looking forward to seeing me when I get back. I said, oh yeah, sure. Let's have lunch together. You know, Jimmy. And then when I talked with the colonel, he said, the reality of it is, this is an election year.
There you go.
I said, president's not doing well with his foreign policy. He's way behind in the polls. And he says he just recently, if you haven't seen or read about it, again, newspapers, articles, you only have a couple of news medias that are out there. Mm-hmm. Half of them that exist today or more didn't exist back then. No internet or nothing. I said, no, sir, please enlighten me. He said, well, do you ever know who the Lion of the Senate is? The Lion of the Senate. I know I've heard it somewhere before, but, in passing. It's Senator Ted Kennedy from Massachusetts. I said, oh, yeah, I remember this guy. Mm-hmm. He said, well, he says he's thinking about actually running and splitting the Democratic ticket against the president. And I said, well, that's politics. It's way above my pay grade. Mm-hmm. Recently, I haven't been following going on. I was more worried about if they were going to shoot straight and not make a mess of executing me. And he says, yeah, I can understand your priorities, but here's the way it's going to go. There's going to be a lot of dirt coming out and flying around after you get back on the news. You're probably going to be asked a lot of questions, want to have a lot of interviews. We're going to have a PIO, public information officer, or a PR guy assigned to you so that whenever you go anywhere on television or radio, whatever it's going to be, that they're going to shadow you. So what the questions you can and what the questions you cannot answer. I didn't get the grasp of what he was really trying to tell me. And he said, look here, pal. While you were in prison, Ross Perot, a little crazy billionaire down from Dallas, Texas, he owned at least several companies, but one big company called EDS. Two of his executive officers, Bill Gaylord and Phil Chapion, they were taken from their homes and literally kidnapped. They thought they were in the same prison as you. They were being held hostage. While this argument was going on about how they're getting them home, that's when the embassy got hit and you got taken. And they thought they were in the same prison as you. And because there was a problem with the Carter administration not giving enough time and attention to getting these guys back. And Mr. Perot was not going to pay the money. Basically, he went and hired his own mercenary team, hired an ex-Army colonel by the name of Bull Simons. And this was a movie later that I found out. It's called On Wings of Eagles. And the book was by Ken Follett. And it actually names me in. It's one of the several books that I'm named in it, and the events in Tehran. The book hadn't been written yet. And he said he went in there and he hired them, and they busted into the prison and got them guys out. But they were in Qasar prison. Once they found out where he was, it wasn't Evin prison, because they had thinking about if you were going to be executed, that they were going to snatch you up too. So once we found out you were in Evin prison, it was two different operations, and neither one was going to be sanctioned by the U.S. And I guess he got his tit in the ringer a bit, so hiring them and sneaking them out through the back ways of Turkey. But the colonel was telling me, he said, I'll basically give you literally marching instructions. When you land, a plane will finish and taxi. We landed at Andrews. The doors will open. The band will play. There should be a red carpet there, although they're wondering if it's going to be actually rolled out for you, because it was raining at the time, and that carpet, you know, would be slippery. And you know, my eyebrows, you know, were like this. And I said, all for what? You know, for a sergeant that did his job? And he says, no, from what I understand, you'll be receiving the Purple Heart and a Navy combination, a Cross of Valor. And I said, and the first time it hit me, he said, where's all the other Marines? Where's everybody else in this embassy? They're still sitting back there. There's people, fellow Marines, that did just as much as I did, had just as much risk in their life in the firefight. What are they going to get? And he says, that's one of the things I want to talk to you about. You don't ask questions about them. You don't make comments about them. And I wanted to ask why, and he just said, that's the way it's going to be, Sergeant. Do you understand that? You're going to answer the questions that the handpicked news media is already going to ask you, and you're going to know the answer, and that's the way it's got to be. Do you understand? And he says, that's not a request, by the way, Sergeant. I say, I get it, sir. I mean, I'm that much savvy, you know, to figure out where you're coming from. He said, so the door will be open, and it's for photographers to take your pictures. We'll be standing behind you when we tell you forward march. You walk down that ramp. He said, your mother will be there. Your three sisters will be there. Senator William Hines will be there. He was a friend of the family of my dad's when my dad was in the Navy and he was alive. They know him. But he was also my senator from the state of Pennsylvania, when at the point I didn't have a senator. My mother did, my sisters did, because they lived there. I was in the military, so I didn't even have a home state. All my mail came to APO or FPO overseas. So he's as good as any. And we really liked his Heinz ketchup and all his condiments. I said, how neat, I get to see the extra ketchup himself. So while we're there, he said, you went around the world, and it was at the point with this, we were talking about that, On Wings of Eagles, or Ross Perot. And he said, when they found out that you, where you were, and not in the prison where they could help you, and that you had been condemned to death, Jimmy Carter said, no, he's not, that you were not to be put on trial, but it was already too late. That was after the fact. So you were, you know, found out, to be, or it had been, your murder trial was over, what, 30 minutes? I say, yeah, something like that. And he said that you were condemned to death. And at that point, if the president had let you continue to stay there and be executed, it had been a reason, if nothing else, to go in to try to save the other Americans from the same fate at the embassy, because nobody could trust another, you know, 50 people or so at the embassy not to suffer the same fate that you did. So this is a speculation from his point, but I mean, it was a factual speculation that he gave me. I'm sure that this is what's being told him to tell me. He wasn't there at the time in the Oval Office or wherever the decision was made. And I said, so you're telling me I was a pawn at the time. He said, yes, he said, yes, Sergeant, more or less. If Carter couldn't get you out of there and he couldn't stop you from being executed, to go ahead and make the best of my dead body. That hit me so hard. You take my M16 away, you give me a shotgun, I get shot with my own shotgun, and now my own president is going to put me up for grabs. I said, this, you can't make this shit up. That would have been a net. This is something like a conspiracy no one would ever think of. You know, maybe Hollywood or something, I don't know. But he said it was leaked out through through Congress somehow and hit the newspapers via the Pentagon. And when it hit the news, it got blasted. And America, it seems, just want their Marines to be lined up and shot and executed. So he said, you became an insta-popular person overnight. He said, you'll see pictures of you in almost every major newspaper in the United States. And at the time, they'll be printed overseas. You know, where is this Marine? If he's harmed or he's going to be executed, America will come in to save you. And, of course, the big speculation would be you go into the embassy to save the other 100 Americans or whatever that's there, and then what they used to call now is a false flag operation of some type. That rescue mission goes south and sour, or it doesn't go as well as planned. And next thing you know is that now we don't need a SWAT team or, shall we say, a company of special forces guys. Now they're trapped and they're beleaguered. And what happens? Where do you go? No, we got to send more to save the ones we already sent in there.
Mm-hmm.
You know what
mm-hmm.
I mean? Kind of like Khao Tang Island or what happened with the Mayaguez or the Pueblo. Yeah, look that one up and see how much fun that was.
Mm-hmm.
And how we got our ass in that crack. He's telling me that this briefing, this is what is the things that are never going to be told and talked about while you're still in the Marine Corps. Remember is that President Carter is the commander-in-chief. He's your ultimate boss. He can do basically what he wants to. And when he orders you to do something through the chain of command, you're going to do it. And that's just it. You're going to say what we want you to say. You're going to nod your head the directions that we want you to, and that's just the way it's going to be. Do you understand what I'm saying, Sergeant? And I said, yes, sir. It's crystal clear. I get it. So they're making me out to play some kind of hero. And I said, no, you are a hero, son. Hey, some of the stuff that you went through and what you endured and the people's lives that you saved, there's no doubt in anybody's mind whatsoever. Courage or the valor that you espoused out there. And I said, well, I thank you for that, sir. But still doesn't make you feel good is that your own boss and people underneath them for political reasons line you up as a pawn. Had they let me die or had they executed me, it would have been a reason to come in. And it would have been. I mean, then you would have sent in a regiment to save the company. And then you would have sent in the 82nd Airborne or something. And basically, that's what the Carter would have done. He would have went back in and said, okay, we're taking over. And there's not much Khomeini could have been done. He'd had no army, no air force. He had nothing. Okay. He had to pull the PLO in just to use them as marshals in different cities. Trying to put a plan together, an operations plan based on all that. It was just a rush order. Here's an example of it. I said, someone's going to get a Purple Heart. Someone's going to get a Navy Commendation Medal or any kind of accolades like that. It usually goes before a committee. The name of the game is you're put up for that. The committee will consider what the requirements are. If you meet the bare minimums, then they're usually going to have somebody to interview the witnesses or the accounts thereof, or basically prove it. You're going to be vetted. Medal of Honor or, a good conduct medal all mm-hmm. the way out. They've got to see what the qualifications were. They didn't even know what was going on or where you were for the last 8 days. And now all of a sudden, you're getting off a plane, you're having an entourage like a head of state from another country,
mm-hmm.
and you have medals and citations that are already signed, framed, ready to go. That didn't hit me at first. Yeah, you're right. It usually takes about a month or so. Then they're going to be standing there waiting. They're going to salute, shake, take, salute, shake, take, and that's all it's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And that just overwhelmed me for the most part. And I said, to be used like that, I guess, if you're going to be used for any reason, it would have been that one. But what I remember I telling you yesterday is that the most important thing was that not that I cared that I was going to be shot, literally executed. I mean, I was already in so much pain anyway. It didn't mm-hmm. matter. I just wanted to get this over with and just come on, finish it. When you don't lose hope per se, but you lose the logic of hope. If you could understand that, you never really want to lose hope inside or prayer to
right.
the good Lord. You don't. You just can't really. It's almost like disavowing that God even exists. I can't do that. But to say that if it's your will, Lord, that I go this way, well then, okay, fine, so be it. And that's basically what I faced. But here's when you look back in retrospect, I didn't really care about getting shot so much as that what was going to be said about me afterward. And here you go, you fast forward by a couple hours and it's just the opposite. Here they're painting you to give the impression of what happened over there and to use it in a political way so that President Carter at the time made him look good, because he did not have a lot of things that were making him look good, and nothing was positive. They were already slamming his ass for allowing the Shah to fall apart and lose credibility of the ability to the Russians and see what they were doing all the time, when we basically lost Iran. And we already had another problem child over there, so damn insane at the time. Remember that crazy bastard? He was he's next door in Iraq, and he never got along with the Shah or the Ayatollah either way. He thought he was the king in the whole sandbox over there. Mm-hmm. And the proof of that is, I mean, just 9 months later, when they attacked the embassy again in November of 79, shortly thereafter, when they had the 52 hostages, he wanted to invade Kuwait, but he instead, Saddam Hussein invaded Iran. Iran and Iraq, if you remember, look it up in your history books there. Now you can Google it nowadays. 79 to 80, it was a bloody nasty war between the two countries. Mm-hmm. And it had been brewing for some time. So Iran was in a really precarious area. And Jimmy had lost that ability there. And they were lambasting him in the news. The next thing that's going to come up is that he's going to have some way to of several ways to counter what is going to be thrown at him from the Democratic ticket that's going to possibly be split by Senator Ted Kennedy. And also it was going to be Iran versus Chappaquiddick back and forth. And the whole time, Ronald Reagan running against him is just sitting back in a catbird seat going, yeah, you two guys go at it, because that just guarantees me a spot in the White House. Mm-hmm. So when you look at the big pictures of things, this is the way some of these people think behind closed doors.
Yeah.
And he says, you were a big part of that. For 24 hours, you could have changed the world, Sergeant Krause. Your life hung like the sword of Damocles over this administration. And it would have been not their desire or their wish that you were executed, but that they couldn't find you. And if you would have expired for, the lack of anything else, they would have had no choice but to use your death in a most positive way. Mm-hmm. I said, well, if that's the way you want it, okay, fine. I'm glad I could glad I could have helped you out on the day. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, I just want to say here real quick, Ken, that I think regardless of what political party was in power at that time, that they would both have used you just like they use anything they can. That's the way our politicians are.
Yep.
But here's the bottom line, in my opinion, and I'm pretty sure everybody listening to this is going to agree with me, is that you represented the best of us. That you faced overwhelming odds, that you were ready to sacrifice yourself to save people, most of who you really didn't know. You might have known them by face or by first name to say hi in the mornings, and that's about it.
Yep.
But you did your duty. You did it with honor and valor. You did it under circumstances that, even the word overwhelming doesn't really explain what you guys went through, what you and those two other Marines went through. And then you look at what State Department did, and I've got not much more respect for them than I do for politicians, because I've dealt with them overseas and seen the way they are. And I'm sorry to stereotype an entire organization, but I'm not impressed.
No.
So I think that most Americans look at your story as something for us to be proud of. They're certainly proud of you. You are a hero by every definition of that word. You certainly fit that mold. You continue to be a patriot. You're still standing up for your country. You and I have been swapping some text messages here the last few days. And it's like I said today, some of these young people they don't understand what people like you can have gone through, the sacrifices you've made for our country. You see all these protesters out here, and I'm sorry to get on the soapbox, but drives me crazy. You see these people come out and protest. Okay, protest for what you think's right. But what have you done for your country, actually? What have you physically done? Most of those people haven't even paid taxes yet.
True.
And believe me, I hate paying taxes as much as anybody. But that's how our country operates. And so that's just part of being an American. But I don't want you to downplay your role, the significance of what you did. I don't want anybody. I'll go toe-to-toe with anybody that wants to talk differently about this. Unfortunately, it did come down to politics, but that doesn't change the fact that you're an American hero and American patriot, brother.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, so I'll stop talking for a minute. Sorry.
No, Steve, thank you. I needed a break myself there, and I truly want to let you know that I appreciate what you say. Several people on different podcasts and lectures and places and behind closed doors have hugged me and shook my hand and said exact same thing. Mm-hmm. And it's overwhelming, and it's heartwarming. That along with I alluded to while I was, you know, at the embassy over there and not knowing what the outcome would be. Finally, when they found out, they just swarmed to the house where my mom and my sisters lived in Pennsylvania. They sent all kinds of people from all over the country and a few from all over the world would just write down the address and send a letter or send a cards. My mom has cards, shoeboxes mm-hmm. full of cards, get well or prayer cards and from other countries, Canada, Mexico, the Netherlands, and wishing and hoping the best. They didn't even have an address. A lot of times they would say House of Krause or to the mother of Sergeant Krause and say Lansdale, Pennsylvania. I mean, we got we have them. Wow. No street number, no zip code, and they just showed up.
Yeah.
And then years afterwards, people that I've never met, sons and daughters and grandchildren of people that were in that restaurant had said they used to send me cards, Christmas cards, birthday cards, things like
wow.
that. And they would track me down. I'd get them weeks or months afterwards, wherever I was, you know, stationed. Or eventually when I was a police officer, and I got one like 10, 12 years afterwards that I was a police officer. And it finally got to me forwarded. And I said, how old is this thing? It's got to be like 6 months old.
Yeah.
And it says, you don't know me, but I'm the granddaughter of such and such. And she was a hostage with you at the Caravanserai restaurant. She's passed away. So I can almost recognize the name, but the person that was writing it was just, you know, collaborating that to her, what I did and decisions I made and the miracles mm-hmm. that happened that day saved her grandmom, which would have given birth to her mother, or she wouldn't have been here today.
Exactly.
And it's warming heart, things like that. She had, she says, when I grow up, here's something, this kills me, Steve, I love it. She goes, when I grow up, I hope you're still around or I can contact you and you could walk me down the aisle or be there at my wedding.
Whoa.
And she's from,
wow.
She's from Ohio, and I still have that address, and I'm still waiting for the the invitation.
What an honor.
I mean, hey, it'd be great to give people signed copies of my book, you know, that was saying to go back as far into being considered a hero, like you said. It's things like that that warms your heart. And basically, that's why I named the book or titled the book A Marine That Endures Hell, because it was hell. It really was. You read it, you'll have to agree with that.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It's you just to go through hell, it's endure it. You know, you go through the fire, you get cleansed, or you learn just realizes how low you can really go in the depression, and you can get beat up mm-hmm. to a point where you're totally exasperated and there's absolutely nothing left. And that's when I'm not being religious anymore, that I'm being political, is that that you find that you have your faith, your personal faith mm-hmm. in God Almighty. And it changes your life and changes your world.
It does.
It was overwhelming. I mean, just as while I was talking with that colonel, I guess you call him a steward or flight attendant or whatever, came back and said the pilot wanted to see me.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, oh, okay, fine. Well, whatever. Where is he? Where do you think the pilot is? I said, okay. Yeah, he's up front flying the plane. Huh? It's way. Okay, on my way. So he went up there and he was saying, he introduced himself and he gave me a set of headphones and he says, she says, we understand that you are air traffic controller. I said, yeah, military controller by MOS. And he said, put these on there, Sarge. She goes, somebody wants to talk to you. So I'm thinking, I go, okay, is it going to be my mom? Is it going to be, you know, president again? And, you know, and it was one of the greatest voices that I can remember. And I put it in the book, is that I put it on and identified myself. And he says, is there an American sergeant up there? You know, I said, Sergeant Ken Krause here. And yeah, I can't do it that well, even with my Joe Pesci background and voicemail from Jersey. But he says, this is Kennedy Airspace. He says, you are now arriving and have entered the United States Airspace. And just like I'm getting ready to cry now, I went, oh my God. And you could feel it. The pilot dipped the wings a bit and he says, mm-hmm. word of Kennedy. And you could understand that New York accent straight up head. And he said, welcome home, Sarge. Job well done. Marine. He finished with his initials, and I think it was Bravo Mike. When you give a command or you give an acknowledgement on FAA
mm-hmm.
to a controller, they'll end up with Bravo Mike. And I just said, Semper Fi, sir, kilo, kilo. And he wanted to be the first one to welcome me home to American Airspace. As he was a former controller. I mean, he's a former military controller, yeah. And he wanted to be the first one. And man, the stuff like that just it overwhelms me that the people, they don't even know you for no reason, just wants to be part of what you're going through. The whole excitement and the whole things that you can feel of being so lucky or so miraculous. And a short little 10-second blurb of just welcome home. You're in the United States airspace.
I'm sure that was better than meeting any president.
It was, man. It absolutely was. And so just as we're getting ready to land at Andrews, the colonel, I went back and finished talk with the colonel. And he's saying, I just got a radio message that the president was called away or is covering something in the Oval Office. But all the other guys will be there. And here's what you're going to do. And I said, okay, great. And so that's the way it landed. The plane lands and I gather up my stuff. He said, don't worry about it. Just leave that here. He says, your uniform and everything. They had to, piece it together for people that I didn't have a uniform. They had to fit me. So that was over there, snatch it up from supply or whatever at Wiesbaden and in Germany. So I stand in the doorway and the engines finally, crank down and it comes to, and it's dead quiet. All that noise and everything with the engines and whatnot and people talking and then it's just dead quiet. And next thing you know, they put the rampway up there and the door opens like this and damn man, Colonel says, Marine, that tent. And I came to attention and it's just waiting and waiting. And I'm feeling it. I mean, they had wrapped my toes with a brace around it. So you can see if you ever look at the pictures or look at the actual video of me getting off the plane, how I'm limping. Because what they did, they just put the toe back in the great toe, my right great toe, back in a place and wrapped it and taped it so that you could actually walk. Yeah. And the next thing I know is that the Marine Corps hymn started to play. And I looked over at it. I got pictures of it in the book. It'll show there's at least 100 man band, the 8th and I Corps, the President's Own, something that another heads of state. And they were all in their dress blues and a dress right, the reds. And I looked out and I said, just dozens of people, colonels. And I think colonel was about the lowest rank I saw. There was generals up the wazoo. And then colonel behind me said, forward. And I just, that's the order to forward march. I said, well, there's only one where to go, down these damn friggin' steps. Mm-hmm. So as I start marching down the steps and the Marine Corps hymn is playing. And it was, my God, man, it's like something out of a dream is that because hours ago, I was being drugged up steps to be shot. And now I'm being walked down the steps to be accoladed. How much more ironic or how much more can that be opposite in a world? So then I finally see my mom and she comes running over to me and she grabs hold of me and it almost knocks me over and I can't lift her because my ribs are still cracked and wrapped. My stomach, I can't even lift anything with stomach muscles. Forget it. That's over with. I'm barely holding my own ass up in the air erect. So the iconic picture that went around again, this picture went around the world. They've seen it. I've got it at least on a dozen different newspapers. And it's got a picture of me picking up and hugging my mom. And
very cool.
Yeah, a Marine comes home. I said hello to my sisters, and I limped over to and saluted the Commandant of Marine Corps, Lewis Wilson, 4-star general. And he said, "Follow me." And we walked down a shake and take type of a greet and meet. And it was Graham Clater, Secretary of Navy. I mean, it's just, there's the whole entourage, everybody, including, like I said, Senator Hines. I got the picture in the book where we're standing underneath the wing of the plane because it's just starting to rain again a little bit. After I shook everybody's hand and I said, look, he said, they realized that I wasn't able to salute each and every one of them. I said, the pain and the stitches and everything. I just couldn't get the arm up, and he says, just don't worry about it. And, I said, well, I just want to let you know, it's going to be a very short salute. And I would feel, I'd feel bad about that. They brought me over to another line. And, he says, as the entourage turned and as went walking towards me, I said, the, commandant was the first one to come up in front of me and pin the Purple Heart on me. And then Graham Clater, the Secretary of the Navy, had the Navy commendation with a Combat V pin on. And they had the certificates, which is the citation. You get a medal, but you also get a citation that explains the circumstances of, why you'd be receiving that medal. Mm-hmm. And the colonel had said, right, now on the plane, he says, you normally don't see these things for weeks at a time when you get put in for them. 48 hours ago, they didn't even know where you were. Now, look at that. They got it all prim and proper for you. And the voices in my head were saying, where's the other Marines? Where's the other guys that did just as much as me? How come they're not getting these accolades? But I was ordered and told and reminded not to bring that up. I don't know why they weren't. We could have a speculation talk about that. A few times that the short times when they did come back from Iran, they never received any anywhere near the accolades and accommodations that I did.
Mm-hmm.
I felt sad and bad for them for that. And because of that, I was sort of ostracized. And whenever I tried to contact them, it was always a hard time to find out where they were. Some that got out or some that were sent back to their MOS, wherever they were in the Marine Corps. Remember, we didn't have the internet or anything where you could just Google something and find somebody. It wasn't that easy. Right. You had to go through headquarters of Marine Corps. Where's Corporal so-and-so? Where's Sergeant such-and-such? You know, I'd like to talk to them or send them a message. What command are they under? You could, you know, hunt them down. I felt kind of lonely in that. We spent probably close to an hour out there talking and taking photographs and doing the whole PR work. And then I had to let them know that, I mean, look, I feel weak. I feel tired. I can't stand up much longer. I'm going to collapse and just, you know, look ugly. Mm-hmm. And he says, no, we're finished with you now here today. And the band played on and played more songs. And the last song they had was the Marine Corps hymn. And we stood at attention and they marched off back into the buses where they came in on. And while they were filing out there, Senator Hines came over and said that, he says, the plane is ready. And his personal private jet was sitting there. I think it was one of the nicer Lear jets back in 1979.
I think it said G2 in your book.
I think it was. And if I look back on what it was back then, I climbed the board, my mom, my sisters, and the senator, and his security detail and entourage, and off we went. And I remember it was a very short trip from Andrews Air Force Base. We were flying back into the Naval Air Station at Willow Grove, Naval Air Station at just in Warminster, Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. 20 miles north of Philly. So that's where we landed there. And there was another entourage waiting for me and a hometown type of folks. And I got pictures of those right there. And you can see the looks on my face. Of this. I haven't had much sun at all. I was pure white. So my eyeballs were sucked back in. I hadn't, you know, gotten enough nutrition back yet in the body to make up for everything that I lost. And he said, man, you look like death warmed over. And I said, man, what I've been through, I feel like I've been ate by a wolf and shit off a cliff.
All right.
So they welcomed us home, and the news was there. And for the most part, we got a bodyguard. What's the best way to say it? An escort all the way home from the air station to where my mom was living in Lansdale, maybe 15 miles away. Mm-hmm. And it was military and with state troopers. And as they pulled in down my street, it's amazing because even with the rain that was out there, we got home like 7 o'clock at night, and it was kind of dark. The streets were lined with all kinds of neighbors, all kinds of friends. Kids are standing out there. Welcome home, Sarge. Welcome home, Kenny Krause. Glad to see you. God bless you. And there was people from the DAV, from the American Legion Post. I mean, there was another 100 people just lined on the road where my house was. And I couldn't get over it. And they said, we've been following you. We prayed for you. And I mean, I still have the banners in my storage, and I've got pictures of those in the book of just to welcome home Sergeant Krause, welcome home Kenny Krause, glad to see you, things like that. So the little bit of a nap that I had on that plane just re-energized me to a point where I get to the house, and finally the news was there. I had to, you know, answer questions with like that, and I remember just saying it got to a point where I was just so overwhelmed that I was saying it was the last question for the night, and that they all can, you know, get hold of Senator Hines had left his personal executive secretary in charge of setting up interviews, you know, in the next days to come.
Yeah.
And I remember getting in there, and like I did in a book, and I'm looking for this little dog, a little beagle by the name of Snoopy.
Yeah.
And I had left him when I went to Marine Corps, and I saved him. He was a rescue. And then my mom had gotten him so damn fat. He was like a 50-pound beagle, and his body was so much bigger than his little head that I almost didn't recognize him. But when I just finally collapsed in a chair and hugged him, and he licked me, and I said, now I know I'm home. When I'm getting licked by Snoopy there and getting my love kisses, I know I'm really home. And my sister just said, well, I said, what do you need? I said, a drink. And he said, well, what would you have? I said, anything made in America. And then she there goes, I says, I'll fix you one. I might have one with you. And nice. That was the end of it for the night. And then a couple of days later, I had to get the report down to the Naval shipyard where the Navy hospital is. And they wanted to take a look at me and say, you look like you were in pretty good shape there when you first got off the plane. He said, you're limping a bit and you can't raise your arms and anything. So they were going to at first. Their plans were from Wiesbaden. In Germany, do the triage. And then when they said he's good enough to do whatever they got planned for me, and the colonel told me on the plane, then when they got off, they said, he's okay to get on the plane and go back home. We'll get him down to the Navy Yard or the Naval Hospital in Philadelphia. He doesn't have to get over to Ralston Army Hospital there, or Walter Reed, mm-hmm. I think it was. And I said, okay, then with the most part of it, there we go. It just started after that. The news just inundated me every day. People are talking. Good morning, America. It was just show after show. Get a knock on the door. And after I came back from the Navy hospital, they said, well, you got a lot wrong with you there, Sarge. You're going to have a lot of little scars left over, but here's what we're going to do with your foot, your toe. We're going to need to break it again and put a pin in it to make it straight. And, you know, here's what happened to your intestines and things like that. It took like about 4 feet of intestine out and mm-hmm. sewed it back together like a garden hose. I mean, they did a really good job on fixing me up, he said. But he said, the worst part of it is, he says, they broke your coccyx bone. They fractured it. And I said, yeah, I know. I felt it every hour that I was over there. And he says, as young as you are, it might not heal completely in line with the way it should. And in the near future, if we don't set it right, because we can't put a cast on your butt, he said, what's going to happen in your later years of life, your spine might not grow along the straight structure that it should. And he was dead right. When I got to my 40s, you start to see the lower part of the spine is tilting away from the hips. And it's just something I got to deal with the disabled American veterans. But they're working with me. That was good. So recuperating at home there, nobody knows what they were going to do with me. I'm still all over the news. And there was nothing else going on at the time. You know, we're talking the last couple of days of February, first week of, you know, March of 79. And I get a knock on the door. And here's a field grade major. Full green uniform, Marine. His name is Vic Burlingame. And he introduced himself and that he was assigned as my personal PIO, public information or PR officer. And that wherever I went, whatever I did is going to come through him now. We have to make sure that he's basically the secretary and that anytime that we go on a radio talk show or a TV show at that time that was there, because they didn't have podcasts. And he said, we will have the questions that you're going to be allowed to answer. He mm-hmm. says, you can answer the true questions. We're not telling you what to say. We are here to tell you to be a filter to what you will not say. And I said, okay, that's fine. And I got an invitation to be the Grand Marshal of the Dorchester Day Parade up in Boston. I said, okay, that's great. Never been to Boston. Have no friends or family in Boston. Don't know why. Guess who's from Boston? Uncle Teddy, the Lion of the City.
There you go.
So it's one of those, we're invited up there to a, talk show and the Wimey, Dimey, 69-me type of thing. And it was up on the talk shows there. They flew you up there, first class accommodations everywhere. They shut down the USS Constitution and on a tour. I got my own private tour. Of course, the only other people on there was the news. And it got to be handlers that were assigned to Senator Kennedy that eventually, once they got me guilt-ridden with the dinners and, all the entourage and everything that's going on, is that what did you know, when did you know it, how did you know it, and all kinds of dirt questions about what happened in Iran. And after they approached me with these questions and things, it was not in the presence of Major Burlingame. So I had to go to him and let him know what was up. And he said, hey, you set up another meeting with him. You have him call me. We're going to sit down and talk together. So when we did in an hotel up there, the basic things went through is that the sergeant is not going to be allowed to answer those questions. He said, basically, no to any more entourage or fanfare, no more dinners. I mean, we're out of here, basically. I asked him what the problem was. And he said, do you realize that you are going to be accusing the president of the United States of things that you can't prove and that for the most part is going to embarrass him and maybe even possibly put other lives in danger or jeopardy around the world? I said, oh, yeah, absolutely, sir. What do you think? I'm asking you what these guys are asking me. These are not just friendly questions. These are dirty laundry questions. And he said, yeah, we can't do that. The power that the chief of the armed forces, your president, has over you, you have no clue. You end up in Adak, Alaska, shoveling Kodiak bear shit somewhere for the rest of your life in the Marine Corps. You open your mouth the wrong way and circumvent this or cause embarrassment, you'll go from hero to zero in one day. So yep. I said, oh, I understand that. I mean, I get it. But, I mean, that's just where some of this political, you know, stuff went that year. And so we went back to him, and we talked to him. I said, look, I still have 3 years left in the Marine Corps. I mean, you can't wait that long for me to get out. Who's gonna care? You're not going to be a hot potato anymore. And I told the guys, basically, I said, yeah, if you want to put $2 or $3 million in a bank account over in, you know, Switzerland. Now, that's a lot of money back then. I could live the rest of my life back, you know, 1979 on $3 million, okay, over there, so that when I get out of Fort Leavenworth, after being court-martialed and all these accolades and everything going out the window, and you know, what would it be worth? And I said, well, not my freedom. And I've already had a little stint of what it's like to be in a major prison. I'm done with that.
No desire to go back.
Yeah, we had to turn him back. We had to turn him down. But it wasn't hard to turn him down. I mean, I knew how what kind of trouble I could get into and the type of questions after that. It came easy.
Right,
and,
How long did this go on?
Oh, my God. That's a trick question, because what happened is that it continued to go on, but it didn't get as much media attention, because at the time, Three Mile Island, the nuclear disaster – up there in Harrisburg, struck, and don't quote me when that. I think it's the middle of March sometime. You know, they had that leak and the reactor cooked off. So
that was the new news.
The news, yeah, that was all over the news everywhere, especially when they found out that there was lies that were perpetrated deliberately for this, you know, safety of the people around there, that radioactive iodine and things like that did not get out, did not seep out. There's no danger to the public. Well, you know, 2-3 days later, when people got their own Geiger counters or radiation detection, they go, hey, that's bullshit. This place is hot. Mm-hmm. And they realized at first they didn't know. They didn't know how bad it was. You got a couple of dead reactor techs and no one's talking. You just don't walk in and assess it like a crime scene. It's a lot more engaged in that. So I don't blame them for what they did, but that's not, you know, in my ballpark right. of business for the most part. So to answer your question is that it stayed just as busy. And I was getting called. I went to L.A., Phil Donahue, Johnny Carson. I'm getting invitations everywhere to, you know, talk and see what's going on. But after a while, they can only ask you so many questions. They can ask you basically the genre of the questions, your personal life, your military life, similar to you. What part of this story have we not covered yet?
Right, okay. Right.
And some of it that the briefings and things that were classified that I couldn't talk about, some of the stuff on the plane and what you've heard now since then, and that was 46 years ago.
Yeah.
So almost all the players are dead and gone anyway. So now you can talk about it. And I've gone through the Freedom of Information Act and, you know, let the parties to know, be that, hey, I plan on writing the book and I'm put it in there. If you don't want me to, send me a cease and desist order or tell me it's classified somehow.
Yep.
But there's really nobody at the Marine Corps. There's nobody in Washington, nobody in State Department that you can call on the phone and say, hey, I'm writing a book and I want to find out this information back in 1970. They don't have the records of it. And if they did, no one's going to call you back. There's no section. Nobody has that job to do that. So you just got to, you know, basically sound the drum and say, hey, I'm going to play this music and people are going to dance. If you don't like it, you know, tough shit. And I haven't been sued and I haven't been, you know, indicted on anything yet. So, I mean, there you go.
Well, let me ask you about the demons that go along with this. I mean, the danger, the physical danger part is over, but the mental danger is still there. How do you deal with that? And have you ever gotten rid of those demons 46 years ago?
Jesus, that's the one question that sometimes I fear so much, is that because it's so new back then, is I'm going to say to you is I'm reminiscing now of what I had to talk to myself about. Mm-hmm. And first of all, you have to say, when do you stop becoming Sergeant Krause the hero and just become Sergeant Krause or Staff Sergeant Krause? Now you get promoted, being the air traffic control Marine, you know, and be a normal life. You know, how do you go from being there to, you know, just being normal again? The first part of it is that you were so busy and you get accolades, and that what helped at first was to not hide it, but avoid it. The avoidance was easy because you're carrying yourself as the hero sergeant. Then it comes time where you got to make a decision in your life. Timing and making decisions, opportunities. For instance, came time for now my reenlistment. I've already have 8 years active in there, and I've gotten married, and I have a wonderful son on the way. And I'm starting to think now, and it's 1982. I mean, can I ride out this this hero binge for, you know, just so long? And I said, but is it going to fade when you're when you go back to the civilian world? And what do you want to do in the civilian world? I have to start looking at, if I don't reenlist, you know, what am I going to do for a living? And then the other one is, if I do reenlist, you know, where is how am I going to live with that? So you're looking at the opportunities and doors and windows that are open, and that keeps you busy to a point where you've talked about, yes, in generically, you were tortured, fine. You were beat, fine. You were shot, fine. You were shot up, beat up, blown up, everything you think of, but it's just generically, see? That's good. And you got the accolades and the wall for it. Now you move forward, and one of the doors of opportunity was President Reagan's is in office, and PATCO, the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Association, decided to go out on strike. I think it was 80, 81s. And he fired them all. He told them Friday afternoon, come Monday morning, if you're not back at your job, you don't have a job. It's massive resignation. And a lot of them didn't come back in. They lost their job. So that was just another feather in the cap where I'm looking at saying, well, I got less than a year left in the Marine Corps, and I've got, you know, all this experience and knowledge. I've made contacts out the wazoo. Why not get out and, you know, get a job with the FAA, being a controller? Got out, and I went to moved out west to New Mexico with my family. And I applied for the FAA to go to Oklahoma City. That's where the boards are to learn how to be an air traffic controller. Again, like, and we talked about it, the heart murmur thing popped up, and I had to get a waiver to go and get my control tower operator's license to become an FAA controller, which I never got. So I had to take second choice. And it seems like whenever I've had to have my heart broken on a mission or on a desire that I wanted, go to Annapolis, be a Navy SEAL commander, you know, there's something in God's will that, you know, physical wise wouldn't let me do it. Same thing with a controller. People don't realize air traffic controllers have to, you know, go through a very stringent one flight examination, just like a pilot does. You have to be just as good shaped as a pilot is.
Wow.
Where I'm going with this, to answer your question, is that these opportunities come in, and now we're saying, where are you going to go? What are you going to do? That's where Department of Energy came into play. And I applied to be a nuclear courier and transport the nukes around the country. And big money, pretty easy job. They're just looking for Rambos, guys that were, you know, ready to risk their lives to make sure that valuable equipment, i.e. special nuclear material, weapons grade uranium and plutonium, and configured warheads. We travel around the country all over the places, going from different DOE sites back and forth. And that's right up my alley. It was great. So at that point, you don't really care about the demons and things that were in, because you're riding high with them. It's the accolades were with you. Where it starts to eat at you, now you're getting about 30, 32 years old, and you're not riding those accolades anymore. Time is changing, and you're changing with time. We're starting to learn what's happened. And since the loss of Iran, you keep looking at things every few years with every administration coming up, the advent of the internet.com and cell phones, et cetera. So things change. These opportunities let you know that you can go Google something, you can go right back in and take a look, and the pictures and the people. Fast forward when you guys start having the Marine barracks that was blown up in 1983, okay, and then you start, you know, seeing what's going on to the Middle East in with Israel and Iran and the accuracy that they got there. Those opportunities and windows of information that come in, those are the ones that trigger you to say, I was there, I know, and people come back, and now they want to know your opinion and feelings on it. And I said, well, my feelings and opinions are what I said before when you've asked on television and on radio. I don't have any more insight today than you do, unless you sit in on the intelligence briefing or something, because they change on what people know. And it's where I think probably about 10 to 12 years after I got out of Marine Corps in 82 and was working with the Department of Energy is that when we're driving around in our safe, secure transports, we're basically armed truck drivers are what we are. You're doing your job and you're away from your family, or you're earning obnoxious money and you're doing everything really well, but you wanted to know why these people pick you to do such a weird job. And all the guys that were with me, the teammates, were Special Forces guys, former SEALs, former Green Beret, Rangers. A lot of Rangers were in there. And we all have different war stories and training. Some things are missions that these guys were on that were never, ever heard about, that they could talk to you about it. And that's where you start to ask them, say, hey, do you ever have dreams, or you ever have something that bothers you about this, or something that triggers it? That's where I started to realize that the sleep deprivation that you get, where you don't get into the deep REM sleep, mm-hmm. you're still in a light sleep mode, and I guess you think you're getting it, but that being a courier is the configuration. You have a driver, you have a communications officer, and you got the backup driver, and we're constantly rotating. So even though there's never been a serious attempt to divert or hijack a nuclear convoy, the idea is that you just like being a guard at the embassy, your embassy may never have been a generic threat for a terrorist assault, but at any time it can be, and you always have to be alert. You can't be completely just looking at the birds and the clouds all the time.
Right.
But when I'm saying, doors and openings, opportunity, all the same type of guys in the military that was there, we started to share feelings about it. I'll give you an example. When I smell curry being cooked, it instantly makes me think of being over in Iran, or being in one of the countries that, curry is a major food staple. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I like the flavor of it, medium to hot, not really hot. There's some really hot curry out there, let me tell you. But when just the smelling of it alone brings back memories. And I remember when you read the book, or we talk about Menachi, my waiter friend who got shot right in front of me and died in my arms, that'll come back to me. I smell curry. After Kamina came in, they started showing pictures on the internet, was up with the type of lifestyle they live over there now. The women have to go through, and that Sharia law in Iran, wearing a full chadors and a lifestyle there. You start to see that more often. You see that. And when I see one on the street over here, instantly it brings back memories. It changes what you're thinking about. For instance, I saw one when I was walking down an aisle at the supermarket. I had my buggy, and I come around the corner, and there she is, complete burqa, and the child she had in the stroller was completely covered over too. Something has stopped me, Steve, and here's this voice out of nowhere. It says, "What if she's got a bomb in that basket?" Now, I did not get out of bed this morning thinking about a female going to be a terrorist and blow herself up. Mm-hmm. Why did that just trigger me to think that I did not want to walk past her? As a matter of fact, it continued to change everything I was thinking about, including shopping. I pulled my buggy back and went down about four aisles over. And why? I'm talking to myself, just in case she does have a bomb in there, it's going to blow up. How sick is that? How wrong is that? That's a demon controlling you. That's an inner subconscious fear that, for no reason at all, they shouldn't bother me. Mm-hmm. And I went around the corner. I seen her again, but she pulls up along next to a guy from the Middle East, and you can tell by the way he was dressed, and you can almost look into the bag and into the little buggy there and see that there was a baby inside there. Mm-hmm. But it's things like that that you start to realize you need to talk to somebody about it. At the time, it was named the post-traumatic stress neurosis, and then when I got out, on my exit exam, getting out of the Marine Corps, they looked at my background and they asked me about a dozen questions about mental stability. And they were all basically negative. No, didn't want to hurt myself. I don't have nightmares or dreams or anything like that at the time. They didn't put me in for any, mental therapy or anything. Mm-hmm. But a couple years later, after a certain job that you have, or talking with people about it, you're saying, yeah, I do have those feelings and I don't like them. You start to look at people that are off in the Middle East and paint them all with the same brush. And I said, I'm not going to do that. That was done to me, and that was done around me over when I was in the Middle East. And it's just wrong in general, in logic and spiritual morality. It's wrong. You can't paint them all. You never know what they're thinking or feeling inside. The bottom line was, I was not going to let them control me anymore. Okay? I'm home here, free, fairly sane, you know, healthy, wealthy. I'm doing great. I got everything in the world to be blessed for. Why am I going to let these people fill my mind and my heart with hate and hate them for just looking at them? Well, I'm over here in my own backyard and those people aren't even around me. It's just the sight or smell or sound of them or their background, their culture is always going to make me hate or always make me stop in my tracks and think negative things. No, I want to talk to people. I went and got counseling. I finally got signed up with the VA and sit down and talk with them. And I said, I don't know at times what triggers them. I can sit and talk about this book or this interview, and it's not going to give me any bad dreams or anything like that. But I could then look at sometime during Easter and look at a movie or something like the Bible or something like that that's been on 100 times and watch that one show. And then that night, toss and turn back and forth, and that would be a trigger.
Yeah,
it's the triggers come and go. They're different. Some are similar to other people. I don't have the same ones where you pop a balloon or fireworks or something like that and get shot at. After I got out of the Marine Corps, I still like firearms. I went on to, you know, be a courier. We carried more weapons than you can imagine. And so being around fireworks or machine guns or mortars or anything like that, loud noises, didn't scare me. Some people that I was with, it would. Vietnam vets or ones that had been to Panama or Grenada or things like that. We were together in a talk show or a counseling session. They never been around that kind of exposure in combat or seen some of the, you know, horrific things that scare the living hell out of you. But you still have to do your duty. You still got to do your job in a line of fire. And then after you live through it, they go back to being a civilian job or something different. Mm-hmm. So their environment of like mine is different. So as their world changes, that they don't follow things going on in the Middle East. They were never there. They don't care. So those triggers are different. If I thought there was something that would bother me or brings a bad feeling out or something like that, an argument with somebody that you had over a debate or something, then I would avoid that at almost any cost. It's not worth it. I'm not going to convince you any different than I could if it was changing gods and religion or arguing sex and politics.
Right.
And you're not going to change their mind. Why waste the oxygen and the time? But there's things that I call them demons, is that things that want to control your emotions or in not just control what you're doing, but it's the opposite. It's a void. They won't let you feel sorry. They won't let you cry over things you should cry or let you feel empathy or sympathy for things that you get go on in your life. As I began to get through my 20s, my 30s, my 40s, my 50s, it's not normal that I don't cry over things like this. It's normal that I don't care about things that you make decisions on in life. I start making principles out of it to defend myself of why I don't have a void of these feelings and things that you should have. I've had 3 divorces. They're good women. It wasn't because of money. It wasn't because of cheating or beating or drugs or alcohol or anything. It's just the compatibility of the way I wanted to do things. The number one that if you got to have to put them in order was that I wasn't ever going to be controlled. You're not going to tell me what to do.
Mm-hmm.
Voluntarily wise, well, what's it like being in a uniformed police officer? I volunteer for that. I sign up and I swear that I will follow the lawful orders of those above me and provide service and protection to the people that are under my watch, which are basically be your citizens. You know, but I do that and wear the uniform according to the standards. I will do it. So it's a volunteer type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But when someone tries to control me and tell me what I can do, what I can't do, that really unnerves me. And you say, well, nobody likes to have that done to them. Yeah, but I'm talking about small, minor things where it's not just moving something around the house or, you know, doing something that's annoying. Anybody gets annoying. Steve, I'm talking about stuff where somebody wants to change the way you act or react to something. They're trying to change your DNA structure of how you actually think.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they were trying to do in Iran. And that triggers the living shit out of me.
Yeah.
And you are going to get pushed back. You are going to get a fight. And it's going to be a fight just like the caravanserai. I didn't realize that that was the whole issue. The demons wanted me to continue to put up that facade. They wanted me to continue to feel controlled or someone was going to own me or keep me hostage again emotionally or spiritually. And the whole time, I didn't realize they don't. No one has power over me unless I give it to them. you can't insult me unless I value your opinion of some type. And it's taken a long time to get through that because I thought that they were stripping me of my ability to defend myself. And that was a big factor in dealing with these demons. And then when you realize that, you lock them away and you don't give them any credence. That was the most important thing to do. You disarm them, okay? Mm-hmm. And you don't fight them. You just say, you have no power over me. I'm going to lock you away, and I don't care how many times you come back. You're in the darkness. I'm going to turn on the light, and you're going to be gone. Okay? You can believe that all you want, but then when you start to look at exactly those examples that I was talking about, I'd write them down in a book, almost like a little diary, and tear them out or put them away. I have literally, again, shoeboxes full of them. And then once it got a few years ago where, you know, you're retired, you're trying to figure out what you want to do with your life right now and where you want to go. You're in great shape. It's health-wise, sanity-wise, can argue that. And then you have more time in your hands than common sense. And you start to talk to people, and when the stuff that's happening over in the Middle East all the time, they say, hey, about this guy? Whatever happened to the hostages? This guy down here, we see what happens when it went to Iraq, all right? We went in there, we took 500,000 troops and everything that we had in less than 90 days and took it over to another country, kicked the shit out of Saddam Hussein and gave their people back, you know, their country. And the world looked at that and went, oh my God. And then the same thing is that we can bring power to bear to get rid of evil in the world in places like Afghanistan. And just recently, they say you got a crazy bunch of people over there in Iran, not the people that live there, not the citizens per se, but the psycho weird beards that just are hell bent on destroying Israel, no matter what. They don't want to live a normal life. They just can't stand the last 46 years saying they're intent on destroying Israel. Okay. And I'm not picking sides right here, but I mean, I can give you 100 videos of the weird beards over there saying, no matter what, we're spending what, 26% of their gross national product just on military, like they need it. They got more oil than they got sand. They don't need nuclear material, especially weapons grade stuff. The point being where I try to tie this in at is that while this stuff are windows and doors of opportunity that open, don't walk through them right away. I tell people that have post-traumatic stress, try not to get involved in those things. Give your opinion and then walk away. Say, my opinion is good for me at this time, talking just to you. Mm-hmm. Don't interject it into the big picture. It's not there. I said, it doesn't always apply. And they said, don't get caught in a trap. Try to avoid things that is going to trigger and piss you off. They've been looking for now 46 years. They've asked several times, whatever happened to all the hostages and the 52 and the 444 days? And most of them are dead, are gone, committed suicide. A lot of them just don't want to even talk about it. I mean, yeah. If the average one was 30 or 40 years old, that's 46 years. That's almost half a century. And for whatever personal reasons, they withdraw and they don't want to be around. So there's very few with the exposure like I had, both in the military and in law enforcement, that people would want to come and, you know, get an opinion. And I feel that it was my duty to try to tell them what post-traumatic stress, what's the pros and the cons with it, and how did I deal with it, like your demons. And here's one is that, all those little notes and things that I put away and it came to bear is that when they start to say, why don't you write a book? And I was afraid to unchain those, that demon hole and let them bastards out again.
Yeah.
Could I control them? Could I be able to deal with people from the Middle East, Iranians, without harboring hate or discontent? And once I decided to write the book, I've had more Iranian friends over here, Persian friends, and I even went back to going to Persian restaurants, eating their food and learning their Farsi again. You know, good morning, how are you? How do you feel? You just talk to them and you tell them you have no control over me. I will deal with you as a one-on-one person, the way you think and the way you treat me or the people around you, not your politics, not your religion. If you use those for the betterment of man, that's great. And as long as it doesn't hurt me or people around me, I'll take you at face value.
But words of wisdom.
Yeah, if you want to, you don't have control over me. You just refuse to have that control. So once I realized that it's about time to do the book, and maybe there's so many people, so much stuff had happened after Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan, and now they really do understand the post-traumatic stress. Not just combat vets, but people that have been through traumatic first responders, right, of police officers that have been in firefights, and they've shot, I've talked to them in shootings. You know, they fired several rounds within 5 feet of a perp who fired another five rounds. 10 rounds fired, less than 10 feet. Neither one of them hit.
Mm-hmm.
I can relate to that, buddy. I was almost blown in half with a shotgun. You wonder why I'm still here as a medical miracle. I know. So we can discuss things like that.
Yeah.
Firefighters. Who in the hell ever wants to meet a firefighter? You can't even get close enough to a blazing building that rats and everything else are running out. And you've got to figure out, is there anybody still left in there? And I guess the concept of hell is a good example.
Mm-hmm.
But yet without fire, when you go camping or something, you need to survive and exist.
Yep.
So when you start to see what firefighters have to do, and you know, they sit around and, you know, look at television, or they sit around and in their trucks, but one day, 1 hour, for the rest of that one day, they are going to go through living hell and torture and terror, and they have to be ready for it. There's an old saying is there's only two times when disaster will strike, or when your enemy will strike, so when you're ready and when you're not. And people that constantly stay on the edge, so that when the 911 or the bell rings or you get a 9/11 in New York City, the World Trade Center, how do you respond with that? How
right.
do you lose a whole company, 300 and something firefighters gone, evaporated? Most of them, you didn't even get their bodies and DNA back. Now, you want to talk about post-traumatic?
Absolutely.
Sit on with that.
The 2 weeks ago, we had Will Jimeno, who was a Port Authority police officer that was trapped in the towers on 9/11, one of the few people that was saved out of there, and his demons still come around.
Well, they do.
It's horrible.
I'm not saying there's any set way to fight them. It's each and everyone personal, and that's what makes it so difficult. Because as the world unfolds and it gets more violent and crazy, you're going to have more and more people with post-traumatic stress.
Would you agree, Ken, that anybody that is suffering from, whether you call it PTSD, demons, depression, anxiety, the first thing you need to do is go talk to somebody? Would you agree to that?
Absolutely. Go talk to somebody is the first step, because you were looking at the person in the mirror and admitting that you have a problem. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's not your fault. And it can be fixed. It can be controlled. It really, you could control it, but you got to want to do it, and you got to learn how. So the first step is you want to admit it. You got to have the desire to get it done. Then you have to seek out the appropriate type of medical or psychological. But I can tell you one thing. For me, drugs, illegal drugs, opiates, I never had a real deal with it because I wasn't that much pain for the most part. I know a lot of vets that did and do still have to deal with the opiate addictions, alcohol, any of it. That's not an excuse. It's not going to help. I mean, a glass of bourbon at night when you sit around talking with your friend and have a cigar and talk, that's fine. Not a bottle of bourbon.
Right.
There's a difference. And not every day. Okay. So you got to be cognizant of the traps that are out there.
I just want to mention very quickly for our listeners out there, you've heard me talk about this before, and I will continue to as long as this podcast is on the air. If you're in a position where you think you're suffering from any of those, anxiety, depression, PTSD, demons, you need somebody to talk to, we have a national telephone number in our country, 988. That's all you got to do. It doesn't cost you a nickel. You can text it. It's manned 724-365. They will put you in touch with professionals to get you somebody to talk to. There's no reason to think that you have to go this alone. All you have to do is dial 988. Ken, you have given us almost 4 hours of your time now. For our listeners, you know, he went on to be a 21-year veteran of the Roswell Police Department there, which is a suburb of Atlanta. I'm just not going to ask you to spend any more time with us, because I think what you endured as a Marine, you set an example. You set a bar. There's a standard. And the standard, you met the standard of the Marine Corps. You met the standard of a military person from the United States who went and faced danger, faced it down, risked your own life. You traded your own life to save 22 people. You're talking about the trauma factors that people go through. I've read articles about that lately, and the average American goes through 4 to 6 traumatic events in their life, and that can include the death of your parents. First responders and military average 400 to 600 traumatic events in their life. It's not even not a competition, but just to put it in perspective, and man, you lived up to the oath that you took. You continue to live up to that oath. You're trying to still get the word out there. You're trying to still help people. That's why we go into law enforcement. I think that's the reason most people go into the military. I know some go in there to avoid jail, but you might have been at that point at one point in your life. But you
that's not a chapter. That's not a chapter in my book.
There's a discussion, I remember. But just before we go here, Ken, is there anything else you'd like to leave with everybody about your experiences? Maybe somebody consider going to the Marine Corps or the military or joining law enforcement.
I can say that I would never, I don't have any regrets whatsoever of serving in the armed forces of my country. It's different today with politics and with new players out there, the technology and things, they all come into play. Also, is in law enforcement. People ask me, after you went through what you went through, how the hell could you be around weapons and criminals and things? And I don't look at it like that. When I have to answer their question, I have to qualify through my filters to say that I kind of felt robbed that of my opportunity because in the Marine Corps, because I did not reenlist. They would have let me reenlist, but they were going to restrict my background. And I know what I would have been controlled with, you know, all this in my record book. Mm-hmm. So I felt that I didn't have the full opportunity to fulfill my greatest desire, which was service. I mean, I'm just service oriented. I'm this guy that picks up the sword. I'm the guy that doesn't let other people get bullied. And when the best thing that came around was the opportunity that I talk about, windows and doors, got to be, you know, look for them. Sometimes the analogy is the window looks shut, but is it locked? The door mm-hmm. is closed, but is it locked? Go over, try it and shake it and pull it. It just might just pop open for you. And it did for me. So I thought that being a police officer would be almost like a secondary way to pick up and finish the rest of my life of serving people and doing the right thing, setting the example and living the example. And that's a great feeling. That's a great amount of gratitude that you have every day when you're going to work and putting on that uniform, even if it's undercover or when nobody doesn't see you, and being a CSI like I was going into the aftermath of a bloody crime scene. But somebody has to do it, and somebody's got to do it the right way according to the law. And yes. I volunteer to do that, so I'll do it according to the laws. And that's why I stayed in the trenches. You know, you got all these years in the Marine Corps and then another 20 years on the street as a police officer. And I was just driven to be service oriented. And I always ask myself that when I was putting my badge and gun on in the morning, I said, why do you do that? There's so many people out there that care so little about what you're going to do. Yeah. And as the politics from the 70s, 80s, and 90s, you see unfolded, I'm not going to let them influence my desire to be of service to my public and my city that I would any more let the bastards that are over there controlling the Middle East, the violent terrorists, make me hate everybody that looks like them or has the same religion. I'm going to take each person case by case, police report by police report, do as much as I can for them and help them. And I'm helping myself and I'm helping the world to do that. So if you feel that you are service oriented, it's always good to share your feelings of why you're there, why you were, I'm going to be a police officer, a responder. I mean, what are you really into it for? Is it movie mm-hmm. accolades? Is it something that you just can't live without? And it's something that I couldn't live without. I could have had any other type of opportunity. I could have went back to college and, you know, I had a lot of opportunities. I followed my heart and I don't regret it for 1 minute. And if anybody ever wants to sit down and talk about what it's like to have a feel for different calls and be absolutely ecstatic when something comes out and you help somebody for no reason, you get nothing in return except just a mm-hmm. hug or a smile, that makes the whole thing worth it.
Absolutely. So listen, everybody, if you'd like to find out more about Ken on social media, you can find him on Facebook and TikTok at Ken Kraus, K-R-A-U-S. On LinkedIn, the same, Ken Kraus. You got to get a copy of this book. And now that he's talking about this advanced edition, I read the original edition, so I'm going to have to get that one. The name of the book is Ken Kraus, A Marine Endures Hell, the first Marine held hostage in Iran during the Iranian hostage crisis of 1979. Ordered mine on Kindle off of Amazon. I don't know if you're, sounds like you're doing book signings, so you don't. If you advertise those, keep them around. You can get an autographed copy from Ken personally. Highly recommend this book. If you forget about Amazon, you can go to the Game of Crimes podcast website. Click on the book list at the top of the page, and you'll see a link to Ken's book that will take you straight to Amazon. Ken, what a true honor to have you on here. I want to give a shout out to Eddie Molina again for making this introduction and for Constance Payne for carrying that introduction to where you and I actually got put together. It has been a true, true honor to have someone who has served their country with such honor in the military as well as in law enforcement and everything else that you've done that you make us all proud, brothers. Like I said earlier, you're one of the best of us. And I know we have a lot of listeners outside the United States, and I'm not apologizing for this. We live in the best damn country in the world. It's because of people like you, brother. Truly is. So, you know, watching you causes me to get emotional. I'm just that proud to have had you here on the show, brother. Hopefully when I get to Atlanta to visit our kids up there, you and I can get together and meet in person and go out and share some more stories.
Absolutely, sir. Looking forward to it. Thank you for the opportunity to let me share what's on my heart and mind. This is kind of like a therapy for me. And what's really good is that it reminds me that everything I've ever done in the line of service on either side of the uniform or the badge is because of great America and it's people like you that makes the sacrifice worthwhile.
Excellent. Well said, sir. So to our listeners, thank you. These were long episodes this week. This is not usual for Game of Crimes, but it was absolutely worth it. Every second that we've spent talking about these topics was worth it. I can't do any of this without your continued support. If you haven't gone over to YouTube yet to check me out, please do. When you get over to that page, type in Game of Crimes Podcast. It's at the top of the page in the search bar. Click on the subscribe button. Listen to some episodes. Click on the like. Feel free to leave me comments. Yes, I do read all the comments, even the ugly ones. So don't be afraid to tell me what you think about things. I'd love to hear what you got to say about Ken. And I will share whatever comments I get about Ken with him. That's the least we can do for a national hero like this. I like to say this every week. I don't understand why you folks continue to come back. But in reality, I do understand. Because you love coming back to play the biggest, the baddest, the most dangerous game of all. And that's the game of crimes. God bless. See you next week. Ken, thank you, brother.
My pleasure, sir. Semper Fi.